The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off today with a little bit of health. Silent epidemic of broken bones. It's easier than ever to prevent and treat osteoporosis, but the number of cases is on the rise. How can you avoid becoming a victim? And there's a picture here of broken legs, broken knees, vitamins, different kinds of hip joints being broken and stuff. At age 53, Lisa Russell slipped on a Del Mar, California sidewalk and fractured her arm. A bone density scan recommended by her gynecologist because of her family's history of thinning bones revealed osteoporosis. She threw away her high heels, quit downhill skiing, overhauled a diet to include more calcium-rich foods, and started walking with a backpack filled with books. Weight-bearing exercise is an important way to strengthen your bones. Russin also began taking calcium and vitamin D supplements and a bisphosphonate drug, the most commonly prescribed osteoporosis treatment. She considers her fracture to be, well, something of a lucky break, no pun intended. My mother had broken her hip in the past, and when there was no treatment for her osteoporosis, says Rustin, who is now 58. After I broke my arm, she fractured her shoulder. By the time I got the news about my bone density test, my mom had passed away due to complications from her shoulder fracture. That was my wake-up call. Osteoporosis, a term literally meaning porous bone, arises when bone cells that break down are not replenished by new ones. That causes bones to break more easily and take longer to heal when they do. Over a lifetime, 50% of all women will have an osteoporosis-related fracture, a risk greater than the odds for heart attack, stroke, and breast cancer combined. For men, the odds are up to 1 in 4. In fact, a man over 50 is more likely to have such a break than he is to have prostate cancer. All told, of the 2 million Americans who have osteoporosis-related fractures each year, 300,000 will break a hip. Among them, half will never walk again without assistance. 1 in 4 will die within a year. Osteoporosis doesn't just break bones, it smashes lives. What makes osteoporosis even more tragic that in the past 25 years it has become highly treatable and even preventable? Dual injury X-ray DXA scans, which measure the amount of calcium and other minerals in your bones, are accurate enough for the World Health Organization to use them as their criteria for diagnosing osteoporosis and its precursor, osteopenia. DXA scans are also effective to predicting fracture risk. They are covered by Medicare and most private health insurance. Bisphosphonates and other drugs that treat low bone density can reduce the risk of fractures by 40% in women and up to 67% in men. But despite these advances, fractures are becoming more common, not less. According to a 2018 study, after a decade of declines, the number of broken hips rose 2.5% in women aged 65 to 69 and 3.8% in women ages 70 to 74 between 2013 and 2015. E. Michael Lulwecki, M.D., the lead researcher and a director of the New Mexico Clinical Research and Osteoporosis Center, estimates that 11,000 hip fractures and 2,000 deaths could have been prevented over those 3 years. How is this increase in fractures possible? Deep misunderstanding about what really affects our bones, overblown fears about bone-building drugs, changes in health insurance coverage for bone scans, and the "I feel healthy, so I must be fine" hubris of aging baby boomers have all combined to put our bodies at risk. We have our blood pressure checked regularly and our cholesterol levels measured, but too many of us ignore screening for bone health, Dr. Lewecki told Newsmax. If you want to avoid becoming a victim, keep in mind these important medical findings. Bone density scans are the key. The only way to tell whether you have osteoporosis or osteopenia is with a bone density test. DXA scans, the gold standard, are recommended by the National Osteoporosis Foundation, NOF, for women ages 65 and older men age 70 and older, and as early as age 50 for those with at-risk bones, such as postmenopausal women, smokers, and anyone who is underweight, drinks more than two alcoholic drinks a day, has a family history of osteoporosis, or has previously broken a bone. But don't wait for your doctor to order a scan. If you've had one broken bone, research shows that the odds for another increase as much as ninefold. Yet in a 2017 NOF study, 96% of women who'd had a fracture said their doctor still didn't recommend getting a bone density test. After a heart attack, people are evaluated and put on a plan with medication and lifestyle changes to prevent another one. The same thing should happen after a fracture, says Bart Clark, MD, the president of the American Society for Bone and Mineral Research, and a researcher at the Mayo Clinic of Medicine and Science. A big part of the problem is that the number of private physicians with DXA scanners has dropped 26% since 2017, when Medicare reduced the amount of money it pays doctors per scan. Most hospitals still offer scan, but in rural areas, this can mean that patients have to drive hours to get one. As a result, since 2008, nearly 3.7 million fewer women on Medicare have had bone density tests than had been projected. On the plus side, in 2018, a coalition of bone health groups recommended that after a hip or spine fracture, all healthcare practitioners involved in a person's care, from ER doctors and primary care physicians to gynecologists, orthopedic surgeons, physical therapists, and registered dietitians, make sure there's a bone check and, if needed, treatment. That's already happening in approximately 200 medical centers around the United States with good results. Kaiser Permanente's Southern California Healthy Bones Program, for example, cut second fracture rates by up to 60% in 4 years. If you're younger than 40 and have risk factors for osteoporosis, it's not too easy early to talk with your doctor about getting tested. Anyone 40 or older, meanwhile, can estimate his or her fracture risk with the online fracture risk assessment tool, FRAX, at Sheffield, that's Sheffield.ac.uk/FRAX. FRAX doesn't replace bone scan, but it is a good way to help you decide whether you need one or at a risk for a fracture in the next 10 years. Men also need to get tested. Some younger people do, too. Osteoporosis isn't just a woman's disease. Don, now 74, a retiree in the Clearwater, Florida area, he asked us not to use his last name, was diagnosed with osteoporosis at age 44, despite an active lifestyle that included daily walks and 48 miles of weekly bicycling. I had strained my back, and x-rays of my spine showed if it was deteriorating, he says. It runs in my family, though. I think I'm the only man who inherited osteoporosis. Scientists don't know why, but men have a higher risk for death after a hip fracture caused by osteoporosis than women do. So it's especially important for men to get scanned and treated if necessary. Don's DXA scan results improved after a year of bisulfonate treatments. I had a stomach problems with daily pills, but a weekly pill was okay, he says. Now I focus on healthy eating, take vitamins D and K and calcium, and walk every day. My bone density is staying stable. Don's story also demonstrates that younger people are increasing risk. While osteoporosis is most common in women over 60 and men over 70, a 2018 University of Nevada study found that the average density of thigh bone of Americans as young as 30 was significantly lower in 2014 than in 2005. Too much sitting and too little activity are likely the top reasons for the decline, the researchers concluded. But there are other surprising risk factors. Weight loss, surgery, diabetes, breast cancer, and air pollution are all associated with bone problems, as are androgen deprivation therapy, used to treat prostate cancer, and corticosteroids, used to treat rheumatoid arthritis. Supplements alone aren't enough. A study found that about 3 in 10 postmenopausal women believe that simply drinking milk or taking calcium supplements is all you need to prevent broken bones. In fact, the research on calcium and its frequent sidekick, vitamin D, is mixed. Two recent large reviews of well-designed studies suggest calcium and vitamin D don't reduce fracture risk. But a 2018 study did show that a higher intake of daily foods is associated with higher bone mineral density and a vertebral strength in men. For now, most experts suggest getting 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium and 400 to 4,000 HJ of vitamin D a day from food and drinks. A glass of milk has less than 30% of the recommended calcium and 25% of the vitamin D. Besides dairy, you'll find calcium in kale, broccoli, canned sardines with bones, and fortified breakfast cereals. Salmon, tuna, and egg yolks provide vitamin D as well as calcium. If you can't get enough through food, Dr. Clark recommends a supplement of 500 milligrams of calcium plus 600 IU of vitamin D for people younger than 70 and 800 IU after age 70. It's also important to have an overall healthy diet with enough protein and not to overdo alcohol, caffeine, sodas, or refined carbohydrates, he adds. Note that no supplement has been promised to prevent fractures in people with osteoporosis. Some could even be harmful, such as strontium, a mineral found in stronger bones that's now off the shelves in Europe after European Medicines Agency warned consumers to stop using it because of increases in heart attacks and blood clots. Take bone-protecting drugs if your doctor recommends them. Biosulfonates, including alginate Forsamax and ibanodurinate Bonovia, reduce the risk of fracture by slowing the breakdown of bone cells. They are most commonly prescribed drugs for osteoporosis because they work. Yet these drugs are often a hot topic for the wrong reasons when newcomers join osteoporosis support groups, such as Bone Boosters of New Mexico. People are terrified, said Marge Peterson, 77, a retired teacher from Las Cruces, who started the group. They've seen so much negative publicity and misinformation online or have been scared by other people about side effects. In fact, the number of Americans using biosulfonates dropped by more than 50% between 2008 and 2012, a National Institute of Health study reported. There are certainly side effects, bone, joint, and muscle pain, nausea, heartburn, and gastric ulcers. More rarely, the drugs can lead to an erosion of the jawbone. 1 in 10,000 patients may experience a thigh bone fracture, too. But the risks, says Andrea Singer, MD, Chief Medical Officer of the NOF, are very low, far lower than the risk for a fracture of untreated osteoporosis. Your doctor might recommend periodic drug holidays or trying alternative medications. Some of the newer treatments show great promise. A game-changing 2018 study of 2,000 women with osteoporosis found that the biosulfonates zoledronate, Rayclast, reduced the risk of a fracture by about one-third. Ralifexine, Evista, and denosumab, Prolia, are alternatives to biosulfonates that also help show the breakdown of bones. Why do they have these long names for these drugs? Terepotretride, Forteo, and abalaparanatide, Tylenol, the latest osteoporosis medications to be approved by the FDA, work differently. They actually help build new bone. Even a little exercise helps. High-impact exercise such as dancing, jogging, and jumping rope help keep bones strong, but so does walking or using an elliptical machine or stair stepper. Muscle strengthening moves work too, as can yoga. People with osteoporosis used to be warned against high-impact exercise because of the risk of falls and fractures. But a 2017 study found that only 30 minutes twice a week of high-intensity exercise improved bone density, structure, and strength in postmenopausal women with low bone mass without adverse effects. And a recent review found that combining exercise with bone-building drugs works better than either strategy alone to boost bone density in people with osteoporosis. Want to avoid breaking a bone? One of the best things you can do is to break a sweat. Change that tune. I can't understand why people are frightened of new ideas. I'm frightened about the old ones. And stories in the national interest. Conspiracies debunked. And there's a picture of Princess Di in her limo, driving along with a small grin on her face. Did the British government murder Princess Diana? Were Americans behind the crash of Malaysia Airlines Flight MH370? Many people believe these dramatic theories, but a new look at the evidence finds no good reason to buy the hype. The murder of Princess Diana. In 1997, a year after she and Prince Charles divorced, Princess Diana was in the backseat of a Mercedes S-Class sedan, speeding through the streets of Paris, tailed by paparazzi. Next to her was Dodi Al-Fayed, son of a billionaire who owned Harrods at the time, Muhammad Al-Fayed. In the front seat were Henri Paul, a security chief at the Ritz Paris, and Trevor Rees-Jones, Dodi's bodyguard. None wore a seatbelt. Paul, the driver, was drunk. Entering an underpass tunnel at 60 miles per hour, Paul grazed a slower-moving white Fiat Uno and lost control. The Mercedes slammed into a concrete pillar head-on and nearly split in half. Dodi and Paul were killed outright. Rees-Jones was conscious with severe hip injuries. Diana lay fatally injured on the floor in the back. She died in the hospital 3.5 hours later. Her body was embalmed that same day. Soon after, Dodi's bereaved father revealed that the couples were engaged and had been expecting a baby, a claim that the embalming made impossible to verify. He began asking pointed questions. Why are there no security videos of what happened? Why was her body embalmed if not to hide her pregnancy by a Muslim? And where was the mysterious white Fiat? The facts. The United Kingdom's Metropolitan Police Service looked into the matter. They found that there was, in fact, a traffic monitoring camera mounted above the entrance to the underpass that would have captured the collision between the two cars. But this camera only monitored live traffic and didn't record the feed. Because the traffic unit's office closed 1 hour before the accident, nobody witnessed whatever might have been visible on the screen. The embalming of Diana's body was problematic because the fluid can contaminate a post-mortem examination's mixology reports. However, the French police and the British Consul General had authorized the hospital to do so because Diana's family would be viewing the body. What about that white Fiat? Authorities investigated the paint it left on the Mercedes wreck. The color was called Bianco Corfu and had been used only on Fiat Uno cars manufactured between 1983 and 1987. A massive dragnet by French police examined roughly 2,000 cars with the paint. None was a match. But even if the British government had chosen to kill Diana, as Dodi's father insinuated, death by Fiat Uno was a horrible plan. Using a lightweight Fiat to bump a much heavier Mercedes S-Class is not exactly a sure-thing assassination. Diana's was a tragic death, but an accidental one. Henri Paul was drunk and driving too fast, which is precisely what the British police found. Who brought down Malaysia Airlines flight MH370? On March 8, 2014, Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 left Kuala Lumpur for Beijing with 239 people on board. It never got there, and conspiracy theorists wanted answers. Why had radio communication ceased 40 minutes after the plane left the Malaysian airspace? Why, when it turned back toward Malaysia, did it bypass Kuala Lumpur only to disappear without a trace over the Indian Ocean? Perhaps the plane had been hijacked, some speculated. Then why hadn't it landed somewhere? Maybe it was a suicide plan by one of the pilots, even though none had shown suicidal tendencies. One theory suggested that the MH370 was being used to deliver a nuclear weapon to North Korea, so the Americans shot it down. The facts. Some airline pilots believe flight M370 fell victim to an electrical fire. If pilots had smelled smoke in the cockpit, the first thing they would have done was to shut down all the electronics they could spare. Thus, all radio and automated communications would have stopped. In any case, there would have been no voice transmission because pilots are trained that communicating is the last priority in an emergency. If a fire was suspected, putting it out would have been taken precedence. The second priority is to find the safest place to land. The flight path, as seen on military radar, suggests the crew was likely heading not back to the mountainous Kuala Lumpur, but to an airport at Palus Langkawi, with easier access and longer runways. It's believed the pilots of the plane, at that point west of Thailand, became incapacitated from carbon monoxide or decompression. The aircraft, which by then could well have been a flying tomb, was presumably brought down by lack of fuel or fire damage. The third priority, communicating with the outside world, is something they obviously never got around to. Roswell, spaceships, aliens, and cover-ups. And there's a picture of these remains at Roswell's UFO Museum, but they aren't real. They're fake and made up. In 1947, after some strange debris was found near Roswell Army Airfield, RAAF, in New Mexico, the local newspaper ran the headline, RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. The next day, the Roswell Daily Record printed a correction, stating it was merely debris from a weather balloon. The coverage raised a few eyebrows until 1991, when retired Roswell mortician Glenn Davis wrote a book based on his 44-year-old memories with UFOlogist Stanton Friedman. Their destruction forms the entire basis of the modern Roswell mythology, including alien bodies, multiple crash sites, and an aggressive military cover-up. The facts. Under pressure from the public in 1997, the Air Force ordered an investigation into the extraordinary claims. It turns out that Dennis wasn't very good with dates. For example, he recalled going to the base one day and finding everyone agitated. He remembered a red-haired colonel accompanied by a black sergeant throwing him off the base. Dennis pointed to this as part of the cover-up, but likely didn't happen in 1947 because the Air Force did not begin racial integration until 1949, and the only red-haired colonel ever stationed there didn't arrive until 1954. Dennis also recalled an Air Force nurse being very upset over the autopsy of three small bodies that were mangled, burned black, and emanating noxious fumes. In fact, those bodies came from a 1956 crash of a Case-91C aircraft, which killed all 11 crew members in an intense cabin fire. Three of the charred corpses were soaked in fuel and had to be moved from the military base because of the strong fumes. The Pentagon and the missile. And there's a picture of the Pentagon where the aircraft crashed into the side of it. Are those who insist that Flight 77 could not have been hijacked and crashed into the Pentagon on 9/11, killing a total of 199 because Flight 77 never actually existed? On the morning of September 11, 2001, something flew into the Pentagon, killing 125 people who worked in the building. All the evidence shows that it was an American Airlines Flight 77, a hijacked Boeing 757 that had just left Washington Dulles International en route to Los Angeles. Or was it? Conspiracy theorists insist that many thought it was a weaponized airplane was actually a missile strike executed by American government and not by the terrorists. Their proof? First, there was no aircraft wreckage at the Pentagon site. If an entire airliner had crashed there, the parts would be scattered everywhere. Second, the Pentagon's defense system would have shot down any incoming threat. That no such system was used proves that the government allowed the attack to take place. Third, the radar track of the incoming object showed a trajectory that was much too tight and unsafe for a 757 to have made. Lastly, only one security camera video showed the object hit the building, and the plane's tall vertical tail was missing from the film. The facts. Two of the main pieces of evidence put forth by the 9/11 truthers are simply false. There was plenty of aircraft wreckage at the crash site, and it's easy to find photos of it online. And no, it wasn't planted later. The wreckage was visible in the live news footage. As for the Pentagon's defense system, it never had any. In all the thousands of aerial photographs of the Pentagon, there is no indication of rooftop defenses. Regarding the plane's approach, if it was indeed a wild and unusual circuit of descent, that would have been unsafe to perform in a large plane such as a 757, but A, it was still within a 757's capability, and B, the hijackers never had any intention of being safe. Moreover, missiles have no need to circle to lose altitude. They can simply descend in a straight line. Large planes can't do that so easily. As for the video of the incoming small white streak, no tail is visible because in the one frame in which the plane appears, it has not yet entirely entered the field of view, so its tail is still out of the frame. Finally, let's consider the sheer number of people who would have been in on the truth in order to pull off the deception. What is the minimum number of employees working for an American Airlines and the airport who have to know of an non-existent flight were added to their database? Everyone from baggage handlers to gate crews would have reported the inconsistency up their chain of command. How many people would have had to be paid off or killed without a single witness coming forward to report this was over almost two decades? Why was Pearl Harbor so vulnerable? The USS Arizona aflame is a picture it shows here. The officer on duty saw the Japanese military radar reports, but he mistook these bombers for Americans. On December 7, 1941, it is a date that will live in infamy for conspiracy theorists, mostly for the many questionable decisions made by the military leaders that day. For example, the aircraft in Hawaii were gathered in groups and out in the open where they were most vulnerable to attacking planes. Ships in the harbor were similarly gathered, making them easy targets for torpedoes. Americans had broken a Japanese code called Purple and should have known about any planned attacks. A radar station at Opana Point detected the incoming strike force, but instead of raising the alarm, Lieutenant Kermit Tyler, the officer on duty, let everyone go to breakfast. And the big one. One of three aircraft carriers were supposed to be guarding Pearl Harbor at all times, yet none was present at the time of the attack. All this has led to some to conclude that the military knew of the impending invasion, but allowed it to happen in order to go to war with Japan. The facts. The military never considered an airstrike likely. According to a 1944 Judge Advocate's report that investigated the debacle, military leaders were more concerned about sabotage, and the best defense against sabotage was to group all the planes together out in the open, making them easier to guard. The same with the battleships. It's easier to guard one cluster of ships than ships scattered around the harbor. But while grouping the ships may have deterred saboteurs, it made them city ducks for the bombers. Conspirators are correct about the code Purple. It had been broken. But it was a diplomatic code, not a military. Intelligence gained from it provided a warning. The ill intelligence gained from it provided no warning of the Pearl Harbor attack. As for Lieutenant Tyler, he did see the planes heading for Pearl Harbor in the radar reports, but he mistook them for a flight of American B-17 bombers scheduled to arrive that morning. A 1942 court of inquiry cleared him of any wrongdoing. This leaves the intentionally absent aircraft carriers. The carrier USS Saratoga was coming out of overhaul in Seattle, leaving only the USS Lexington and the USS Enterprise on duty. With the threat of war looming, both carriers were tasked with ferrying aircraft to the strategic islands of Midway and Wake on staggered schedules so that one was always defending Pearl Harbor. But just as the Lexington left and the Enterprise was supposed to get back, the Enterprise struck bad weather and was kept at sea 2 days longer than planned. That second day was December 7th. Okay, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. CBD goes mainstream. This cannabis compound, purported to ease anxiety, soothe pain, and promote better sleep, is now in hundreds of products, from bath oils to coffee drinks. We surveyed more than 1,000 CBD users nationwide to learn whether and how it's changing their lives. And I don't know about all of you, but I know I get more advertising CBD emails than anything else in the thing. It's just ridiculous. I get 3 or 4 a day. A mother who uses CBD to treat her son's seizures. A veteran hoping it will help her wean off opioids. A dietitian who says it helps her sleep through the night. Even a pet owner uses it to calm his anxious St. Bernard. These are just some of the estimated 64 million Americans who have tried CBD or cannabis oil in the last 24 months. According to a January 2019 Representative Consumer Report survey of more than 4,000 Americans, the survey found that more than a quarter of people in the U.S. say they've tried CBD, a compound in both marijuana and hemp that doesn't get you high, for a slew of mental and physical reasons. One out of seven of those people said they use it every day. Americans of all ages are using it, too. It's most popular among people in their 20s, and with 40% of them saying they have tried CBD, but so are 15% of people 60 and older, and our survey respondents also said it helped. Most of those who tried CBD reported that it was effective, especially among those who use it for anxiety. In some cases, they said CBD allowed them to so eliminate their over-the-counter or prescription drugs, including opioids. Sold in pill form, oils, tinctures, topical lotions, and even in bottled water, coffee, beer, and cosmetics, CBD is already in hundreds of products on the market, and that could soon rise sharply, in part because of recent changes in federal law that allow U.S. farmers to legally grow hemp, according to the Brightfield Group, a market research firm specializing in cannabis. The company expects more CBD market from hemp alone to grow to $22 billion by 2022, up from $327 million in 2017. At the same time, more states are legalizing marijuana itself for medical use and increasingly for adult recreational use. More than a quarter of Americans now live in the 10 states, plus Washington, D.C., where recreational use is legal, including California, Colorado, and Massachusetts. And others, including New Jersey and New York, would be joining the list soon. More than three-quarters of U.S. adults favor legalizing the medical use of marijuana, according to a separate National Representative 2018 CR survey of more than 1,000 U.S. adults, and half support legalizing recreational use. While more Americans may be into using CBD and marijuana, the laws and regulations governing both remain confusing and inconsistent. For example, though marijuana is now legal in one extent or another in 33 states, it remains illegal federally. And despite the loosening of rules governing the growing of hemp, some cities and states have recently cracked down on foods that contain CBD, calling it an unapproved food additive. Meanwhile, some scientists, doctors, and public health officials question what's really known about... Health officials question what's really known about the benefits and risks of CBD itself, and of marijuana, too, in fact. The growing interest in marijuana has renewed concerns about safety, ranging from improved driving to mental health problems, impaired driving to mental health problems. If you decide to try cannabis, here's what to know about its potential health benefits and risk, as well as how to stay safe and avoid potentially dangerous products. Until recently, CBD was an underappreciated compound in cannabis. Growers actually tried to breed it out of plants, seeking strains with higher THC levels, according to cannabis historian Martin Lee. It wasn't until 2009, he says, that growers came across plants containing large amounts of CBD. Some research suggests that CBD may affect the endocannabinoid system, a series of receptors found throughout the body, that seem to interact with various compounds in cannabis, including CBD, and some of which are related to feelings of anxiety and pain, or that help regulate the body's sleep-wake cycles. CBD's most far-reaching health effect may be its anti-inflammatory properties, and not just in a knee or hip joint, but throughout the body, including the central nervous system and the brain, says Joseph Maroon, M.D., a clinical professor of neurological surgery at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, who has investigated the link. In a 2018 review, he and colleagues say such effects could possibly reduce anxiety, depression, seizures, and post-traumatic stress disorder, even benefit people who have suffered a concussion. The best studies of CBD so far have been in the area of seizures, and the results are strong enough that last year the Food and Drug Administration approved a prescription version of CBD, Epidiolex. CR survey also provides some support for CBD's possible health benefits. Among three-quarters of people who took CBD, and it was at least moderately effective for the main reason they took it, with 48% of them saying it was very or extremely effective. And CBD seemed to work well for some of the most common problems, including easing stress and joint pain and improving sleep. Our survey also suggested that side effects were uncommon. Almost three-quarters said they experienced no side effects at all. Also promising, 22% of people who took CBD for one of the health problems we asked about said it helped them replace prescription or OTC drugs, with more than a third of those people saying they tried to use it to replace opioids. And some researchers across the country are now studying whether CBD, alone or in combination with THC, could be a tool in the fight against the ongoing opioid crisis. Where and how CBD is sold? You may find CBD online or in local health food stores or CBD-specific retailers. In CR survey, edibles including gummies and other infused foods and drinks were the most popular way to get CBD, with oils or drops, vape pens, and rubs also common. Look for products that show how much CBD is in each dose, not just the whole product, says Mitch Earlywine. Oh, that's an interesting name. Mitch Earlywine, Ph.D., a professor of psychology at the University of Albany, State University of New York, who has studied the medicinal use of CBDs. Dosages, which are expressed in milligrams or mg, vary depending on the form of the product, and experts often suggest starting with products that have a relatively low dose. For example, with tinctures, Earlywine suggests generally starting with a product that has just 10 milligrams per dose. Avoid products that make sweeping health claims. They're often inadequate and possibly illegal. If you vape, know that the concentrated oils used can contain a solvent called prolopylene glycol, which burned at high temperatures can degrade into formaldehyde, which can irritate the nose, eyes, and can increase the risk of asthma and cancer. So consider CBD vape pens that advertise solvent-free oils. To date, few states testing of CBD products sold online or in retail. The best way to find out whether a product has come what is claimed is to ask for its COA, or Certificate of Analysis. That document shows how a product performed on tests, typically commissioned by the manufacturer, checking for CBD and THC levels, and whether it contains contaminants like heavy metals or pesticides. If an online manufacturer or a retail store doesn't have the information or refuses to share it, look for another product. CBD's legal status. The legal status of CBD is still somewhat murky. 47 states have passed laws legalizing CBD to one extent or another. If it comes from hemp, THC levels must stay very low, 0.3% or below. And the 2018 Farm Bill allows farmers to grow hemp and legalizes hemp derivatives like CBD. The bill also removes CBD extracted from hemp from the Drug Enforcement Administration's list of Schedule I drugs, such as heroin, which the DEA deems to lack any medicinal use and pose a high risk of abuse. Marijuana and THC remain Schedule I drugs. But on the federal level, the FDA still has reservations. That's partly because now that the agency has approved CBD-based prescription drug, Epidiolex, it says that any product that markets the compound for health purposes should go through the FDA's rigorous official drug approval process. In addition, the FDA notes that when CBD is put into food, say a cookie, honey, coffee, or water, it is considered a food additive, and the agency has not yet approved CBD for that purpose. As a result, some local health officials have started to crack down on CBD and food. Michael Lanza, spokesperson for New York City's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, says that the city prohibited CBD in food after being advised by the FDA that it is unlawful to add CBD to food and drink. Regulators in Maine, Ohio, and elsewhere have taken similar steps. The FDA has said it will hold a public hearing in the near future on how to regulate CBD and clarify confusion over CBD's legal and regulatory status. In the meantime, we have found only a handful of reported examples of people who face legal trouble for possessing CBD. Charges in at least one of the cases in Texas were ultimately dropped. Marijuana. This is continued, by the way. Used for thousands of years in religious ceremonies and as a social elixir, marijuana has dozens of recorded medical uses. Pioneer women in the U.S. used it to ease nausea during pregnancy and to hasten childbirth. And by the mid-1800s, early drug companies were marketing cannabis-based tinctures. Today, 33 states plus Washington, D.C. allow marijuana for a variety of medicinal purposes. But how effective is it, really? A seminal 2017 report by the National Academy of Sciences that reviewed hundreds of marijuana studies found strong evidence for it in chronic pain, nausea, and vomiting from chemotherapy, and muscle spasms in those with multiple sclerosis. And it found moderate evidence for sleep problems, particularly sleep apnea, as well as pain from fibromyalgia, MMS. But marijuana clearly poses risks, too. Immediate ones include impaired mental and physical performance, which may be why its use is linked to car crashes. An October 2018 study found that in four states with legal recreational marijuana, Colorado, Oregon, Nevada, and Washington, crashes were up 6% compared with four neighboring states where recreational use was still restricted. And when taken in high doses, marijuana can cause hallucinations, delusions, and psychosis, according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse. Long-term heavy use may even be associated with increased risk of schizophrenia. So that could be because people with schizophrenia may be more likely to use marijuana. Longer-term use, especially when started young, poses a risk of addiction, according to NIDA, and may impair brain development. Smoking marijuana can also lead to lung infections and coughing, even though frequent use isn't clearly linked to lung cancer. One less familiar risk of heavy chronic marijuana smoking can be severe repeated nausea and vomiting, which can lead to emergency room visits. Where and how marijuana is sold? Available only in state-regulated dispensaries. You usually need to be over 21 with proof of ID to purchase. In states that allow only medicinal use, you'll also need a card issued by the state after a health care provider certifies that you have a qualifying health problem. In any dispensary, bring cash. Banking is federally regulated, so few accept even credit cards. Once inside, it's often like a jewelry store, with products under glass display, so you need to talk to a salesperson. Although you can buy marijuana flower, either in loose form or as pre-rolled cigarettes, many smokers vape cannabis using concentrated oil cartridges, similar to e-cigarettes. Look for solvent-free oils. Increasingly, THC, CBD, and other cannabis compounds are also infused into oils or tinctures, as well as teas, cookies, brownies, and other edibles. But it can be easy to get dangerously high doses of THC through edibles because they can consume quickly, so their use requires extra caution. Marijuana is also sold as creams, time-release patches, and even suppositories. Such topicals are more likely to have localized effects, like help a disease a sore knee, and less likely to cause a head high. Staff sometimes put products into a childproof bag or pouch, though extra steps should be taken at home to keep them out of the reach of children. Note that you can also purchase products in dispensaries that contain CBD extract from marijuana. These products may have more THC than would be allowed in those sold online or in retail stores, but may also be more likely to contain what is claimed and to be free of contaminants. That's because states typically require more testing of products sold in dispensaries. Marijuana's legal status. Though the federal government still deems marijuana illegal, 10 states, Alaska, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, and Washington, plus Washington, D.C., have passed laws legalizing adult recreational use. At least 5 other states, Connecticut, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, and New York, are considering it, according to Paul Ammerman, the deputy director of NORML, N-O-R-M-L, a marijuana advocacy organization. An additional 23 states have legalized marijuana only for medicinal use. The distinction between state and federal law may matter most in places where the federal government has jurisdiction, such as national parks, even in states where recreational use is legal. That's also true for airports. Even if you're flying between two states that have legalized recreational use, say California and Colorado, it's still illegal to fly with marijuana, according to the Transportation Security Administration. Local jurisdictions typically don't allow people to use marijuana in public or while driving. However, Denver now prohibits its use in certain registered businesses. Team up with Consumer Reports to test what's in your CBD. With CBD showing up in hundreds of products and more expected, Consumer Reports believes it's important to test these products on behalf of all consumers. We want to learn whether they have as much CBD as claimed, whether they have more THC than they should, and whether they are contaminated with pesticides and other adulterates. That would be complicated and expensive. So as a nonprofit, we're trying something new, asking you directly to help us raise the money needed. Using the crowdfunding website Kickstarter, which draws on the collective support of many small donors rather than a cross-section of the population to fund and spread the news about worthy projects. To join the effort, go to crtestscbd.com. When doctors prescribe cannabis, there are currently only 4 cannabis-based medications approved by the Food and Drug Administration that your doctor can prescribe for you and that you can pick up at a pharmacy, like any other prescription drug. That includes Epidiolex, a drug approximately improved in 2018 by the FDA to treat 2 rare but devastating forms of epilepsy. Epidiolex contains CBD extracted from marijuana plants as the active ingredient. The other 3 drugs, Sesinet, Marinol, and Sendros, have a synthetic form of THC and are used to treat nausea stemming from cancer treatments and, in some cases, weight loss in an AIDS HIV patients. To get FDA approval for those medications, drug makers are required to conduct multiple clinical trials showing the safety, effectiveness, and proper dosage for each of these drugs. Such drugs can be expensive. Epidiolex costs $2,700 a month, for example. On the other hand, insurance might cover their cost, and patients can be confident there is solid science behind that drug's approved uses, and they have what's claimed in the label, says Igor Grant, MD, director of the University of California Center for Medical Cannabis Research. That's not always true of CBD or other cannabis products you buy, especially in a retail store. And then we have the ABCs of CBD. More than a quarter of U.S. adults have now tried CBD, a compound extracted from hemp and marijuana plants, according to a new National Representative Consumer Report survey. Here are some insights into who's using CBD and why they use it, and how effective they say it is. Who uses CBD? 26% of all Americans have tried it at least once in 2 years. How old are they? 40% are 18 to 29, 32% are 30 to 44, 29% are 45 to 58, and 15% are 60 plus. Where do you usually buy your CBD? The typeface on this is really poor. Cannabis dispensary, 40%. Retail store, 34%. Online retailer, 27%. And other, 12%. How often do you use CBD? 21% of people who tried CBD more than once use it every day. Do you expect it as a side effect? 74% said no. 26% said yes. What do people use CBD for? 37% reduced stress or anxiety or help you relax. How effective is it? 63% said it's extremely effective, 17% moderately effective, and 60% slightly or not at all effective. 24% help with joint pain. 38% find it extremely effective, 30% find it moderately effective, and 27% slightly or not at all effective. So about a third each. 11% for fun or recreation. 24% find us a lot of fun. 44%, okay. And slightly or not very effective, 22%. 10% for better sleep. 52% found it very effective. 28% moderately. And 60% just slightly effective. How CBU uses difference by age. Reduces stress or anxiety. 32% of millennials. And 15% help with joint pain. And baby boomers, 12% reduce stress and anxiety, and 42% for joint pain. It shows us we baby boomers have a lot of joint pain. Did you use CBD to replace a drug? Yes, I replaced the medication entirely, 22%. 30%, no, I took CBD in addition to the medication. And 48%, no, I wasn't taking medication. What drug did you replace with CBD? 47%. An OTC drug, Advil, Tylenol, etc. 36% an RX opioid, Dedicone, Percocet, etc. 33% an RX anxiety drug, Xanax, Ativan, etc. 22% replaced an RX sleep drug, Ambien, Lunesta, etc. What form of CBD do you usually use? 35% edible CBD infused food or drink, 30% a drug or spray, drop or spray, 30% a vaping device, 21% a tropical rubber cream, 16% a smokable form, and 15% a pill or a capsule. And we'll take a quick change the subject entirely, and take a quick look at the road report. Tips from our test track: new tires can hurt miles per gallon. Be aware that your fuel economy could decrease slightly the next time you replace your tires. Gene Peterson, head of CR's tire testing program, said it's a common occurrence caused by the increase in the rolling resistance of new tires. As tires lose tread through wear, rolling resistance decreases and fuel efficiency increases. Even if you replace your tires with the exact same model, the new tires could have more rolling resistance than the old ones and will cause a drop in fuel efficiency, Peterson says. The best advice for optimal fuel efficiency handling a long tread life is to monitor proper tire inflation. The vital statistic, 20. That's the number of degrees Fahrenheit the interior of a parked car can climb in 10 minutes. In CR tests, the temp rose more than 105 degrees Fahrenheit in an hour when it was just 61 degrees Fahrenheit outside. Make it a potentially deadly environment. GM, Hyundai, and Nissan have introduced features that remind drivers to check the back seat for kids and pets. And they have an icon here. It looks like a headlight with a bunch of scratchy lines through it. What does this icon mean? Is it a headrest heater is on? Snake and turtle ahead? Fog lamps are on? Speakers are muted? The right answer, of course, is that fog lamps are on. Fog lamps or fog lights, available in most cars, work with your low-beam headlights to better illuminate lane lines and road edges obscured by fog. When driving in fog, avoid using your high beams, which can make visibility worse, and to be sure to slow down. You have less time to react once whatever is ahead of you comes into view. And a recall of a Ford F-150. Ford is recalling 1.26 million 2011 to 2013 Ford F-150 pickup trucks with a 6-speed automatic transmission. This may unexpectedly downshift into first gear while the vehicle is in motion, which can increase the risk of an accident. Ford says it knows of 5 crashes and 1 injury that may be related to this malfunction. What to do? Dealers will update software to address the problem at no cost. For more information, owners may call Ford Customer Service at 866-436-7332. Refer to recall number 19507. Women motorcycle riders are on the rise. Women are a growing segment of U.S. motorcycle owners. In 2019, 10% of all owners were female. In 2018, 19%. They represent more than a quarter of all millennial ages 23 to 38 motorcycle riders, the most of any generation. Helping save more money. What's at stake? Consumers are 15 times more likely to save for retirement if they can have their money deducted from their paychecks. But almost half of Americans, private sector workers, an estimated 87 million people, work for an employer that doesn't offer them that option. The dynamic is partly to blame for our country's massive retirement savings shortfall. A recent Government Accountability Office report says nearly half of all Americans approaching retirement have saved nothing at all. New Jersey is the latest state to try tackling the problem. In March, Governor Phil Murphy signed a law requiring businesses with 25 or more employees that currently don't have offer a retirement plan to enroll their workers in the new NJ Security Choice Retirement Savings Program. The 1.7 million workers who may be eligible will be able to contribute to Roth Individual Retirement Accounts, IRAs, through automatic paycheck deductions. They can select the type of investments and their contribution level, or decide to opt out altogether. But if they do nothing, 3% of their pay will go into investments tailored to their projected retirement date. The funds will be managed by the state, so the cost to business is minimal. How CR has your back? CR advocated for the New Jersey program, calculating key information to legislatures. We have successfully supported the enactment of a similar retirement saving programs in New York in 2018. 10 states have now enacted laws to expand retirement savings options. 6 use an automatic IRA model. Pushing for efficiency. What's at stake? Refrigerators, microwaves, light bulbs, and those and other household goods and appliances are often designed to meet federal energy standards, which end up saving Americans a lot of money on utility bills. About $63 billion in 2015, says the Department of Energy. And those efficiencies pile up, even as the products we buy deliver more features and performance. Today, for example, the average new refrigerator uses a quarter of the energy it did in 1973, while offering 20% more capacity. But today's DOE has fallen behind in updating, strengthening many of these standards, and it proposed a rule that could slow or freeze further updates for some appliances. How CR has your back? CR has advocated for efficiency standards for decades. When the federal government dragged its feet on them in the 1980s, we joined a lawsuit to push for implementation. Now we're taking our case to Capitol Hill in February. David Friedman, CR's vice president of advocacy, urged Congress to reject efforts to weaken the standards, citing DOE's own data showing that the average consumer saves $321 a year thanks to the efficiency standards. The DOE predicts that the standards are properly updated, the number will reach $529 by 2030. Updating and enforcing these standards is required by law, and is the best interest of U.S. consumers, Friedman said. Digging into drug prices, what's at stake? A nationally representative 2017 CR survey revealed what consumers do when the price of their prescription drug goes up. About 1 in 3 spends less on groceries, 1 in 3 takes an additional debt, and 1 in 8 delays retirement. In short, even modest variations in the cost of drugs can have a huge impact on consumers' lives. That's why the results of a recent CR investigation were so troubling. It found that the amount consumers pay for medications using Medicare Part D insurance coverage can vary by hundreds and even thousands of dollars a year, depending on which pharmacy a consumer uses and whether he or she makes a small mistake in the online sign-up process. Our investigation involved sending dedicated CR secret shoppers to price 5 common medications in the U.S. cities. We used the Medicare Plan Finder tool to identify the 3 drug plans that would offer the least expensive retail drug cost in each city, then compared it to what consumer would pay under each plan at 2 area pharmacies. The variations were staggering. As Lisa Gill, the CR journalist who led the investigation, said in her testimony before the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging in March, in Denver, for example, the annual cost of one of the 5 druggers at one pharmacy was $688. At another, just 4 miles away, the same plan charged $1,687 or $999 more for the same drugs. One result of our testimony, the Senate committee has asked the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for changes to the Plan Finder tool. And let's close out with a little bit from the Genius section. Zing, how to craft a comeback, and we'll finish these up next week. Listen before you leap. Spend some time considering the argument that you're... I'm sorry, that's not right. Hang on a second. Check out these legendary comebacks. When Yankee baseball great Babe Ruth signed a contract in 1930 for $80,000, he was asked for whether he thought deserved to be making more money than President Herbert Hoover. Why not, he replied. I had a better year than he did. And with that, we're approaching the end of our program. We're almost out of time. For today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest Consumer Reports, be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Reading Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks very much for listening, and looking forward to talking to you next week.